Is your team not performing well? Is morale low and turnover high? Are you falling further behind the competition? I'm here to help. I'm your host, Shaney, and this is the Leadership Show, where business strategy and culture finally meet, and we make the long-awaited shift from rhetoric to results. I promise I'm not your typical boring leadership consultant, and I will help you get your shift together. Let's do this. Hello, Leadershifters, and welcome to another episode of the Leadership Show, where business strategy and culture meet. I'm your host, Shaney, and today I have one of the most interesting guests I think I could possibly have invited onto the show. Brian Benstock is joining us. He is the general manager and partner in the Honda Acura dealer in New York City, actually in Queens, which is the number one Honda dealer in the world. And let's face it, the auto industry is probably the poster child for industries that are being disrupted right now, and where the examples that he can share with us of leader shifting are going to be extremely relevant to those of you across whatever industry you represent. So Brian, welcome to the Leadership Show.
Hi, Shane. Thanks for having me. So happy to be here.
Thrilled to have you. So let's back up, but you know, before we get to all the exciting changes that are happening in your business and leadership, just stay tuned, because we will talk about the impact of Google and eBay and Elon Musk and ride sharing and driverless cars and all that stuff that is disrupting Brian's business, and I'm sure yours too. So we will get there. Do want to hear a little bit about how Brian got where he is, because I do see the Oldsmobile sign in the back of your office there. Wow. And, you know, we can certainly say that not only is this not your father's Oldsmobile, but this is not your father's world anymore either, right?
Well, it's true. Oldsmobile, I think it's a really good reminder. I'm in my former partner's office, and he unfortunately passed away in 2006. And, you know, I certainly wanted to keep the office the same way, because it's a very good reminder of how quickly things can change. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't too long ago in the 80s or 90s, if you had an Oldsmobile franchise, it was a license to print money. Oldsmobile was one of the, you know, the preeminent brands, selling over a million cars a year. And, you know, sadly, consumer interest shifted, and Oldsmobile shifted the wrong way. And in a very short order, it went from being one of the most lucrative franchises to being put out of existence.
Yeah.
And I keep that in mind, that this can happen to any brand, any manufacturer, if they don't pay attention to the customer.
100%. And that's exactly the direction we're taking with this. But how did you get into the car business to start?
I started selling cars on May 10th, 1982. I did it as a part-time job until something better came along. And here I am, it's what, 30-some-odd years later? And nothing better has come along. I literally was going to do it for the summer. And I saw these people that at the dealership where I worked that were supporting their families and houses and children selling automobiles. I was living in my parents' basement apartment, and I had zero expenses. And I think if they could support their family, you know, maybe I could make a living at this. And I thought I was kind of friendly and indifferent, and I didn't look like those typical car salespeople. And I was able to quickly have some initial success. I worked with some very good people. Nancy Phillips, Paul Singer were incredible examples of what's possible in business. They were really eloquent, elegant, and sharp. And they were somebody that I could aspire to be like. And there were many other examples in the car business that, you know, were just the opposite, that if I worked for them, I certainly would not have stayed in the business. And I found that the more I was like them, the more quickly I could rise. And, you know, I took a really great path. I was a salesperson, then an assistant to the assistant manager, then the assistant manager, then finance, and then sales manager. You know, I really went through the every position that you could in the front end of an automobile dealership before becoming a general manager. And
yeah, that's great. It's always helpful to have played every position on the field, if you will, to then be the coach of the team.
Well, right? Sure. And if you've had a background playing the instruments, and then one day you're blessed to be able to lead the orchestra, it certainly helps to understand and to be to have sat in that seat before. Although yep. it's required, it certainly is. In my case, it was very helpful.
Yeah. And have you always been with Honda Acura, or did you have other brands before?
I've been with Paragon, the organization Paragon Honda, from the very beginning. And we acquired the Acura dealership. It seems like yesterday, but I think it was about 1999.
Yeah.
It's been a spectacular run, going through the ups and the downs of the brands. Honda hasn't really had it down. Acura has had some ups and downs. And, you know, thankfully, the product really seems to be moving in a great direction.
Yep. Well, so speaking of ups and downs, let's get to the meat of what I know the leader shifters are interested in hearing about, which is, how do you operate in what many people refer to these days as a VUCAD world? I can't tell you how many executives I counsel about the circumstances of their industry. VUCAD, for those of you who don't know the acronym, stands for volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous, and disruptive, which is basically the environment that any business is operating in this day and age, right? You cannot escape all the rapid changes and disruption that's happening in virtually every industry as a result of technology, as a result of globalization, as a result of tons of different factors that impact businesses today. So when did you first start to detect that there was a sea change coming in your business, in your industry?
You know, some of the public corporations started getting into the automobile business many years ago, and many of us dealers said they'll never make it because each of our transactions is negotiated one at a time. There are too many variables. It's too complex. We'll never be able to figure it out. And little by little, I saw efficiencies in some of these public corporations. And as they organized data, as they used data better and used technology better, they were able to scale a lot of the things that we thought were not scalable. Mm. And so that started, and that opened the door to a lot of the other professions looking into our business and saying, hey, there's a real opportunity here for us if we can organize. And it sort of reminds me of the movie Casino. You know, back in the day, the casinos were really family-owned.
Right, literally and figuratively.
And then some of the big corporations came in. And you know, they took it to an even higher level, an even better level. And I think the same thing is happening in our industry. There's a consolidation. The consolidation is not bad, unless you're the one consolidated. The consolidation is natural. As means of distribution improve, there needs to be less outlets. And if you look at from 1950 to today, there's been a 50% reduction in the number of automobile dealers in the country. It used to be 40,000, and now there's about 17,000.
Wow.
Yet we're selling many multiples the amount of cars. We're selling 3, 4, 5 times the amount of cars as measured by what they call SAR, the seasonally adjusted annual rate of sales. And that used to be 5 million back in 1950. Today it's 16, 17 million. So less are selling more. And that's efficiency. And I think less is more is everywhere. Dealers have not had to change. You know, you look on the walls here and you see these pictures of these old timers. And the car business really for the first 100 years didn't change all that much. And the reason we didn't change is because we didn't have to change.
Absolutely. They
say the only person that likes change is a wet baby. Everybody doesn't like change. And with some of the disruption that came about, was coming about, and let's talk about electrification and Elon Musk.
Yep.
He sort of pierced the franchise system, going around it using the loophole, these are electric cars, therefore they're not subject to the same franchise rules as everybody else is. And what that does is that opens up the door to people that want to buy a car, but they don't like the experience they were getting. Because, and again, I don't want to paint everybody with the same brush, but if you didn't buy a Honda from me, you bought it from the person several miles away that looks somewhat like me and does it in a similar way. And when we were talking about making the better use of the customer's time, perhaps it took 4 hours to buy a car, and we think we're going to be revolutionary and make it take 3.5 hours. The experience from the customers, it's too long. I don't want to go through this process. Here comes a new player in the game playing with different rules, and really turning the business upside down and forcing dealers to re-examine what they're doing by providing an alternative for the consumer outside of the industry.
Right.
Other alternatives, right, outside of the industry, what about Lyft and Uber and rideshare?
Yeah, I was going to ask you what's the impact. And I want to come back to Elon Musk, but sure. while we're talking about ride sharing, that's one of the big things that was on my mind is what's the impact of ride sharing and I mean, it's ride hailing / ride sharing because they're not everybody's actually sharing a ride, but certainly it's altering the dynamic of car ownership.
It is, and especially in a city like New York City, where right now if you drive less than 11,000 miles a year, it's less expensive to make use of Lyft or Uber than it is to own or lease a car.
100%. The car insurance is astronomical. The garage space in New York City, where I live, is
So you've hit two of the areas that most dealers don't really pay attention to. We, you know, many of the dealers, and myself included, would look at the customer's monthly payment, say that the payment's $500 a month. As a consumer, we know that it's $500 for the car payment. You know, it's $500 or $400 for the insurance, and it's $400 or $500 for the garage. And not to mention the inconvenience, if you're in Manhattan, of taking your car out of the garage, driving someplace else, putting it in some other garage, getting a ticket. I mean, it's all part of the expense of ownership. And then that pesky stuff called gasoline that you've got to put
on.
Right. And so, you know, we can see clearly how ride sharing would impact the taxi and limousine, the yellow cabs and the livery drivers.
Yeah.
But the other impact it's having is on dealers. And I'm happy to say that we've adapted to that, adjusted to that. And the rideshare and Lyft customers, the buyers of those cars, are some of our best customers.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how do you target, because that's sort of a niche target, how are you targeting the drivers in the ride-hailing services versus the average consumer who's parking their car in a garage and using it to go to the beach on the weekends?
Yeah, we've got some pretty good secret sauce. But let me just say this. For years, retailers have been trying to get into our customers' wallets and pockets. I just wanted to get into their phone. And we have a way of communicating with Lyft and Uber drivers, sending the right message at the right time, directly on their mobile device, which I would say 100% of the Lyft drivers are using. So, you know, it's feed the fish the food they like to eat, not the food you like to eat. If a consumer is spending a lot of time in front of a cellular phone, well, let's make sure we communicate with that person on a device and a platform that they're used to using. That's what we're doing.
Absolutely. So, but when we were off camera before we started the podcast, you were sharing an experience with me at a disruption course that you had taken at NYU recently. And I'd love for you to share that with the audience here. There's funny stories.
What a fantastic story. I took a disruptive leadership course at NYU. At some point they said, I set a goal to double Paragon's business from where it is now in 2 years to double that. And the numbers that we're selling right now, we're selling about 10,000 cars a year. 10,272 to be exact. And to take that from 10,000 to 20,000 in a 2 year period would require, I think, a completely different level of understanding of distribution and transportation. And so understanding now that I'm working pretty hard, working a lot of hours, and it's going to take a different level of intelligence and understanding for me to get where I want to go. So
sure.
I went back to school and I took a couple of courses at NYU. And one of the disruptive leadership classes, we were there in the class, and the professor asked each of us why we were there. And I was really impressed with the manifest of the other students. They came from the armed forces, that the Navy SEAL team was sending people, because they were being disrupted. And then business leaders from American Express and some other major corporations were there. And I wanted to look into exactly what was it that was going on, what was causing them to be there. And they called on one gentleman. The gentleman was from Jamaica, and he ran the Jamaica Power and Electric Company. And so the professor says, "And so why are you here?" And I would give a little bit of a Jamaican accent. He said, that man is disrupting us, and he's hurting the poor. And he used a different word.
And I can imagine.
What man? He goes, that man, Elon Musk, he's hurting the poor. And so now I'm leaning forward. And I said, and the professor said, well, how's he doing that? I said, he's coming up with these batteries and these solar panels. And the rich are jumping off of the grid. And every time someone jumps off the grid, that cost, that expense is spread over the other people on the grid.
Yep.
It doesn't hurt the middle class. They can absorb it, but the poor. And I'm saying, wow. A public utility is being disrupted by a private enterprise. That's really interesting. And so they went around to a couple of the other people and they came to me. And when they came to me, I put on my best Jamaican accent. I said, that man! They said, Brian, why are you here? That man disrupting our business. And the professor looked at me and said, what man? The same man, Elon Musk. And he would tell us how he's doing that. And I said, yeah, basically, he's pierced. That's a terrible Jamaican accent. I sorry for all my brothers and sisters from Jamaica. But I said, he's disrupting our industry by piercing a franchise veil that's protected, insulated dealers for so many years.
Right.
And I said, thank God. It's time that we lost that umbrella of protection. It's time that we have to be like everybody else and may the strongest survive. And I think Darwin, you know, said it best. It's not the smartest that have a future. It's not the strongest, but those most able to adapt.
Sure.
And those are not just nice words for the Galapagos Islands. Those are nice words for wherever you're doing business, that you need to be agile to that.
Yep.
And so you've got to get comfortable living on a foundation that's built of quicksand and surfing on that. And you know, as you were saying, shifting, leadership, and being able to let go of these beliefs that you have because they may or may not apply.
Absolutely.
So if I look at transportation in the old terms, I'm looking at buying and selling and leasing automobiles. If you look at it differently today, I'm selling transportation. And I don't care how the consumers consume the transportation, right? That people are not driving less. They're not consuming less transportation. They're just consuming it differently.
Differently, yeah.
Right? If you have children or family, or does anyone you know say, well, I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm just going to sit in one spot. Of course not. In fact, I think mobility is going to continue to grow and expand in many amazing and different ways. And we want to make sure that we're taking advantage of those trends and not holding on to, it's not going to happen to me.
Absolutely.
I spoke at a group of dealers in Colorado. And one of the dealers said, well, that may be going on in New York, but it's not happening here. And I said, it's not happening. Hey, have you ever heard of a company called Amazon? And he said, yeah. And I said, do you use Amazon? He goes, all the time. I said, well, you're subjected to the same disruption. You know, let's a couple of mind shifts. You talk about leader shift, a couple of mind shifts. Let's take a look at what does Google do and what do they do well? Google has a search engine and they're able to put you in contact with products, right? You search and they find.
Yep.
The difference with Amazon is Amazon brings the product to the consumer. Google brings the consumer to the product, Amazon brings the product to the consumer. And that really started me on a journey a couple of years ago for that mind shift. What if we could bring the services, the goods that we offer at the dealership to the consumer instead of them requiring them to come to us? What opportunities might we have? And, you know, you've got to have that shift in your thinking because the manufacturers, Honda, Toyota, Nissan, Mercedes, they have certain requirements for franchises.
Mm-hmm.
The requirements can require that you build facilities that are many, multiple millions of dollars. You know, I mean, that's $20, $30 million for some new facilities. It's not uncommon. And so once you invested in that, you also become vested in this notion you've got to bring customers to you.
Yeah.
And I think that's dangerous because Amazon doesn't rely on that. Amazon brings their products to the customer. So we're sort of saying, hey, we've got beautiful facilities and we've spent a lot of money on that, but let's not rely on just that. Customers that want to come to us, that's great. But there's a whole other breed of customers that we can go to. And I have to tell you, the results in the year or so that we've been on this little journey have been outstanding.
I love that. And I want to take not a TV timeout, a podcast timeout to address the audience. Leadershifters, what Brian just said is really important about ceasing to believe the old stories and the old paradigms, right? It never would have been conceivable even 15 years ago that we'd have people would be hailing rides with strangers in random cars all over the world. It was inconceivable 20 years ago that we'd be buying everything from a bookseller, right? So what beliefs about your industry are at risk of becoming outdated, and you need to get ahead of them? Start to think like a futurist. You can't predict the future, but I've heard many futurists say the seeds of the future have already been sown, right? The future's here. It's just not widely distributed. So you got to really have your antennas up and look to see what transformations are probably coming down the pike for your industry, just like Brian sounds like he's been doing in the auto business.
Yeah, let me underline that. There's a great book called Future Shock that was written in the late 60s, early 70s by Alvin Toffler. And really, a key takeaway is learn, unlearn, and relearn.
Yes.
And I think, you know, that really says it all. We need to remind ourselves of the ability to learn, unlearn, and relearn. And we get stuck on this unlearn. And we dig into our position. No, they've got to come to me for service. And so now, as I start questioning and say, why exactly is it that a customer needs to sit in my service department and babysit their car while it's up in the air? Of what value or benefit is that to the customer?
Well, because they get to sit in your waiting room and drink bad coffee and watch Montel Williams.
Well, you
that's,
sound like
that's right. A benefit, right?
It sounds like you've looked at some of my stuff. That's exactly right. I mean, whatever your political leaning is, it's always the exact opposite side of that that's on the television.
Yes. Of course, yes.
So if you're a Republican, CNN is on. If you're a Democrat,
Fox is on, yeah.
And there's always one of those shows where people are paid to scream at each other, whether that's CNN or Fox News or Montel or, you know, any of these other daytime shows where people, I don't even know if Montel's still on, but my God. And then I you know, refer to it as drink our bad coffee. Or coffee's not bad, but you're not coming here to drink coffee. You've got, and our customers have better things to do with their time. And if you look at it as a math problem, 95% of the time, customers' cars are sitting idle. My car, your car right now are sitting. We're not using them. Why not make use of that 95% of the time when for servicing the car? We're not necessary in that. Certainly, we need full disclosure for customers. Certainly, we need to use technology to provide incredible levels of transparency. But make it easier for me. Know me better. Serve me faster. Wow me everywhere. Mm. And so we started picking up customers' cars at night. When they go after they no longer needed the car for the night, whether that's 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night, picking up the car, bringing it to the dealership, servicing it, and putting it back in their driveway before they need it in the morning.
And
there's no additional cost for the service. You know, we started trying to figure out what should we charge for this. Should you charge an annual subscription fee? And all of my guys and gals on our leadership team, you know, we started out with we charge $50 a month. And then by the time I got to the left side of the table, from the left to the right, it was 50, 100, or 250, to 300. And we were, you know, internally saying we could charge, you know, X amount of dollars for it. And then I put on my Apple hat, and I put on my Amazon hat, and I put on my Google hat. And said,
yeah.
What would they do? And what they would do is they charge nothing and own the customer.
Absolutely.
And own the customer, the customer's loyalty by doing something that's most others will.
For sure. The ongoing profitability of a repeat customer that you don't have acquisition costs for, not to mention all the buying that they're doing, far exceeds what you could have charged them for that awesome service.
And here's the crazy part. As a result of that, they're spending twice as much as they would if they were in the dealership. Of course. Of course. So we call that the ROL, the return on learning. And what a great return on learning. We didn't know that that was what was going to happen. And now it makes complete sense. If you're in my service department, you're waiting an hour. And then after an hour, the service advisor comes out and says, hey, we did the oil change, but when we checked your brakes, you need new brakes. You're going to have two questions. What are those questions?
How much does it cost and how long is it going to take?
Every man, 96% of the people get that right. Now, you can't rehearse that. because you've gone through the drill. And today, let's take a couple of assumptions. Time is more valuable than money.
Yes.
We have solved for the time portion of that. So the money becomes secondary. So if I told you it's going to be, whatever answer I give you, you're not going to like. Whatever, to either of those questions. It's going to be $200 and it's going to take a half an hour. And yet, nah, I'll do it some other time.
Yep.
Either you don't do it some other time, you wait till the lights are on and there's a dangerous situation, or you drop it off someplace else that's more convenient for you. Well, we sort of fix that for our customers. And so I don't need them coming to our multi-million dollar service facility. I need the car.
Right.
And we've developed some technology that gives us greater transparency than you would have if you were sitting in our service department having service. In
other words, cool.
We can show you a picture of your brakes. Here are your brakes. Here are your brakes. Here are new brakes. Would you like to buy some? And you can say yes or you can say no. But from dinner, you're having dinner with friends and you say, oh, I need brakes. Hey, they want $200 for brakes. What do you think? Well, the other place down the road is $179. But the car is there. Go ahead.
Yes, exactly.
And then take a page out of the Disruptor's playbook, Jeff Bezos. Once they click yes to the brakes, then you have the next prompt is, people who bought this usually buy that, right?
Okay.
So we can learn from the disruptors. Let me ask you a question. Who was the first Amazon? It wasn't Bezos. It was Sears, with the Sears catalog.
Catalog, yes.
Christmas time, before Christmas or holiday time, a 4-inch catalog comes to you free in the mail, right?
Yeah.
Free. And there it is. And they had a follow-up one that would come 2 weeks before on the specials right before him. And you remember what was in that catalog?
Everything under the sun.
Yeah, let's take that further. And they took it further than Amazon. You know, you could buy a house from the Sears catalog. One of 15 different brands, and look it up, okay? One of 15 different, I think they sold, it's either 40 or 70,000 homes through the Sears catalog that could be shipped to your lot and built.
Yeah.
You know, so mini bikes, dresses, everything. So Bezos didn't invent the concept, right?
Mm.
In fact, big warehouses. Sears had a warehouse in Chicago that had over 1 million square feet. So when you look at it, what Bezos did, to his credit, he didn't invent the internet. He didn't invent Federal Express. He didn't invent UPS. But he leveraged the stuffing out of the existing technology.
Yeah, and he had great timing.
Well, you know, in retrospect, it seems that way. You know, he, I think, was out there ahead of everybody. He got beat up. Something else our college professor reminded us. To lead is to bleed. And you're going to get out there and you're going to leader shift. And you're going to be out there ahead of other people. And when you're out there first, the tip of the spear, you're going to get hit and you're going to bleed.
Absolutely.
If you're not cut out for that, step aside and let the next man or woman that is prepared to do that. And I have to tell you this, what we're doing at the dealership has been expensive. It's been difficult. And we're learning every day. We're just now starting to see the benefits in the ROI from the ROL.
Right.
The investment from the return on loan.
And there's no alternative. There's an alternative. The alternative is to wither away and die and go the way of the other 22,000 dealerships that had to shut their doors, right?
If I'm to believe the math, over the next 5 years, they say that the headcount is going to drop in half again. So they go from 17 to 9 or 10,000. And, you know, I think as a leader, it's my responsibility to make sure that this corporation is not only one of the survivors, but able to thrive in the land of disruption. Let's keep in mind some of the other disruptive factors that are going on. We've got a stock market now that's at record levels now for, what are we looking at, about 10 years? That's the longest market in history. You've got an economy that's good. We all hope that it continues to grow.
But knock on wood.
Knock on wood, but we all know better. Trees don't grow to the sky.
That's right.
At this point, you know, there's going to be a little bit of a pullback, we hope, not a big pullback. It seems that half the country is rooting for the president to fail. I don't care who the president is, if it's Mr. Obama or Mr. Trump, I want our country to win. I want our
Amen.
Country to win. And that's my political viewpoint. And I want us to do it in a fair manner, but I want to see us win. And So the disruption could be coming in the form of the economy. Disruption is coming in the form of rising interest rates. When I look at my sales staff, I've got a lot of young, super talented people. But when you look at none of these young people that I have ever experienced an economic downturn. They got into business and every year's better. Hey, look at this. And you know, so someone's got to teach them, hey guys, trees don't grow to the sky, put some money away, because it's not always going to be easy. Interest rates, they don't know what normalized interest rates are. People think that the prime lending rate should be below 1%, because that's what it's been for 10 years.
Yeah.
Historically, when I got into the car business in 1982, prime lending rate was over 19%.
Yeah, and what was the typical new car loan?
20% plus.
Yeah, and I remember when I was a kid, my parents' mortgage was in the high teens on a secured asset loan. Yeah.
So you know, and I don't think we'll ever get, I hope we will never get back to those days. But a normalization would be a prime somewhere around 4 or 5%, and APRs to customers on mortgages 6-7%, which could represent, or 8%, which could represent double what some people are paying today. So
right.
Hold to your hats.
Right, which will impact people's ability and willingness to buy new cars.
Yeah.
You know,
to buy everything.
Anything, for sure. Yeah.
Whatever you're selling, we're all fighting for the same dollar out of that customer's wallet. You know, whether we're selling beauty salons, automobiles, houses, you know, it's one consumer per se out there. And when the costs of a consumer living go up, there's less discretionary spending that goes on, period. Yep. And that's not going to change.
Yep, absolutely. Consumer discretionary is one of the most cyclical sectors in the economy. So I just want to shift gears actually back a little bit to Amazon and eBay and some of the online stuff. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we talked about, do people have to come to the dealership to service their car? No, but for years now, they have not had to go to a dealership to buy a car either. And so let's talk about that part of the business and how eBay's, I don't know if they still are, the number one used car dealer in the country and that dynamic.
You know, believe it or not, statistically, still less than 1% of consumers are buying a car online, less than 1%. And that 1% of a 17 million number is a pretty good number. But
yeah.
The reality is that the consumers, I've had trust issues with automobile dealers for many years. And now because the dealer is online, doesn't all of a sudden say, hey, I don't trust the guy in person, but I trust him online.
Yeah.
And I think that's where some of the other disruptors, the Googles, the Amazons, the eBays, that are Carvanas that are offering online buying solutions for customers, they're starting out with a better level of trust from consumers. Paragon Direct, is a service that we launched nearly 7 years ago, and we were ahead of the consumer trend at that time. What it did help us do was to reduce a lot of the time that the customer spent in the dealership by taking care of most of the paperwork online.
Nice.
It's now that we're actually starting to see the fruits of that labor pay for us, where we can offer now a customer a test drive, where we'll bring the car to the customer. They can buy the car 100% online, without dealing with a customer, a salesperson, if they don't want to. Think of this, and I'm working on a project, a book, actually, The Future is Frictionless.
And I believe, you read my mind. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, and the future is frictionless. You know, many businesses are just getting used to Google AdWords and search. How are you prepared to adapt to this new technology that's voice technology? Google sold a Google Home product one every second after October in 2017. Amazon, through its Alexa product, has an Alexa. And you know, what they're doing basically is building a voice infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
And once you build that voice infrastructure, it'd be very simple to say, hey, Google, what's the weather in New York City? And you're going to get the answer, right?
Yep.
And what's the
see? Alexa, stop.
That's actually Google.
Oh, whoops.
Now, the really cool part about that and the learning from that is we just eliminated how many advertisers by using voice to mention. Because if we had searched online, there would have been several options there to click on the service that you thought was best for you, whether it's the Weather Channel, my local weather, whatever you were looking, maybe you were looking for if we're by the sea, if you're looking for the tide reports, the wind reports, and that's been eliminated with voice. How are we as retailers going to take advantage of that?
Right. All of a sudden, people finally figured out their pay-per-click. Now it's archaic.
Yeah, I would say that they never figured it out. Just as they were trying to, the game shifted. Again, you've got to be willing to adapt. And I would say that there will be some things you learn in pay-per-click and in search that will be applicable to voice. But the reality is, if I'm driving in my car and I'm using a Google platform for voice, their voice technology is so incredibly swift, you'll never touch Siri. It's so accurate. I was blessed to be working on a project with Google. And the project we worked on is the first in the world, by the way. It uses voice technology to set service appointments. So I can actually talk to a Google assistant, and the Google assistant right now is on 100 million phones, and say, hey, Google, talk to Paragon Honda. And it will actually talk to Paragon Honda through a bot.
Okay, let's get Paragon Honda. Would you like to book an appointment for a car service?
No. So had I said yes, it would have walked me through the prompts without the need to.
Okay. So cool.
You can call Paragon Honda 866-422-9830.
It would have enabled me to book an appointment without talking to a human being. And I have nothing against human beings. In fact, I am one.
Right. Last time you checked, right?
I've been told by some that I'm not, but that's a good debate. They say it takes about 8 minutes to schedule an appointment, to get somebody on the phone at the average dealership and to schedule an appointment. We can do it in about a minute and a half. So that's a 6x savings in time. And the really cool thing is it ties into an API where with voice, your car will be picked up at your house, brought to the dealership, serviced, and brought back without your need to talk to anybody. The future is frictionless. You click, you don't have to swipe. The other thing you'll have to click is the approval on your smart device. You don't need to download an app, because we all have too many apps on our phones anyhow. So just through texting. Here's your car. Here's a picture. Would you like to do it? Done. Approve that. Sign. Click. Done. You've got a permanent record of the service. You can print out your service history from the beginning of time till now at just a couple of swipes on your phone.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
We think it's providing a great service. But the reality is, I can't do it alone. Our dealership is a really great group. The disruption that's coming, picture David versus Goliath. I'm not going to beat Amazon. It's not going to happen. But by aligning with other disruptors, aligning with an eBay, a Google, and aligning with my manufacturer, American Honda, and using this technology to make the Honda Acura way better than what Amazon can do. This is our game to lose.
Yeah.
To win, right?
Yeah.
Why is it that a couple of pimple-faced kids from California invented Instagram? And Kodak didn't. The day Kodak was filing for bankruptcy is the day that Facebook bought Instagram for $1 billion. They said he was crazy for spending $1 billion. I heard recently that the valuation of Instagram now is over $100 billion.
And it's the biggest, it's the gem of Facebook for now.
So let's, and quickly, just to add something else, and I think if we make it easier for people to do business, I think they'll do a lot more business. So let's look at what happened to film. In one day, more photographs are taken than in the entire history of film. So if photography was around for 120 years, in 120 years worth of photography, every single day, more pictures are taken than in history. And I've had people challenge that. And I say, well, challenge it. It's simple. Look at all of the cameras that are out there.
Yeah.
Cell phones. And people are taking dozens of pictures every day, many people, on millions of platforms because they've made it easier for people. I described to somebody that my daughter, what we used to have to do with film. I said, we took the picture, and you put the film into the canister, and then you crank it and you put the picture. And if you wanted to stop, you had to roll, you know, waste the film, or you wait until you got to the end. Then you roll the canister back up. You put it in a little plastic thing. Then we drive to the photo store. You drop it off at the photo store, and they're usually in a parking lot by a shopping center. So when we go back next week, you can pick up the pictures. And she kept asking this silly question, why? This doesn't make any sense. And I said, you're right, it doesn't make any sense. And somebody figured that out, right? And before the guys at Instagram figured it out, didn't the people at Polaroid have it figured out? Right, in advance, people like Polaroid because of the instant gratification, but they stopped there.
Right, they rested on their laurels and they didn't keep innovating.
Right, and they actually believed that this is the way people like to do it, and they made it slightly more convenient. Like they put the place in one of those little stands in the corner of a shopping center. And they believed that that was convenient. And then they really made it convenient. You could come back in some cases 2 hours later or 3 hours later. What you couldn't do is what you can do now. My in-laws live in England. I could take a picture of my daughter Clementine and I could shoot that picture to England. And Kodak made the mistake. They thought that the quality of the film was what was most important in the initial days of digital. And they asked, the board asked the question, are we going to be able to monetize digital the way we can our film? And the answer I was told was no. And the correct answer, not yet. And is the quality of this 1 megapixel equal to the quality of the film? And the answer was no.
Doesn't matter unless you're a professional fucking photographer.
It doesn't matter. You know, weddings, funerals, bar mitzvahs, yes. To take a picture of my daughter on a swing for grandma, great. And grandma could say, hey, how about the other side of her? And take it and you send it, right? So, and then of course what happens is the quality catches up and then actually surpasses that in the convenience factor. Do you have time for a quick story?
Yeah, of course. And I was just going to highlight what you just described is, again, a company, a whole industry that failed to shift their beliefs forward. They stayed stuck in their paradigm, which was the death nail.
Who had the first patent on digital? Kodak.
They're
game to lose.
They're killing themselves.
Let go of the film. And the CEO of Kodak, when they asked him what happened, he said, one, we effed up. And he didn't say we effed up. And two, he said transitioning was like changing the fan belt on a moving motor. Very hard to do. Nobody wants to stop the motor. And that includes us. You know, I don't want to stop the profitable business that we have now to transition. So you've got to be able to have a disruptive business model as you support your existing business model.
Yeah, absolutely. Because people adopt change at different rates. So there's a continuum.
Correct. I mean, newspapers are still around because there's still some people that prefer a newspaper. You know,
yeah.
I mean, but again, they thought they were in the newspaper business. They were actually in the news business. So the platform changed. So adapt to it. And in fact, the platform became easier to reach greater numbers of people. And the newspaper industry should have been out front. Again, hindsight 2020.
Right.
I'm trying to learn from these lessons.
Yeah.
So other story. We're in the disruptive leadership class and the professor says, listen, we want you to think outside the box and we want you to create a new shopping cart. The shopping cart in the supermarkets has been around for about 100 years. They get used in some neighborhoods as barbecues. They get stolen.
Homeless people have more of them than actual stores.
It's hard to imagine that there's been no change here, and we want you to disrupt it. And we want you to break down into groups of five. And we break down into several groups of five. And I'm the leader of my group. And I take a pen. I say, I've got it. And I draw a box. I draw a box. And I draw an arrow on this box, and a box, and a box, and I draw an arrow on the box, and it looks somewhat like this.
Okay.
And I give it to the professor, and the people in my group are like, what the heck is that? I got it. And the professor looks at it, and he's like, Brian, what is this? What is this? I said, it's the new design. He says, I'm sorry, I don't understand. The other groups must have had architects there. I mean, draftsmen. Their shopping carts were beautiful. And I said, well, this is your house and this is the supermarket. And you order online and they send the food directly to your house. And he said, but that wasn't the assignment. I said, I understand, but that's the answer. I swear, you can't make this up. The next day, Amazon bought Whole Foods for $28 billion. And I promise, I took the class with a colleague of mine, Julian. He was there. He knows it's exactly how it went down. Think of how archaic this is as somebody who's shopped in the supermarket.
Yeah.
Right? You go to the supermarket, you park in the parking lot, you get out of the car, what do? You grab a shopping cart. Then what do? You go into the supermarket, and they're laid out that you have to go up and down most of the aisles, right? They keep the vegetables here, and they keep the dairy there, and you've got to go from one end to the other. So you go through every aisle like a schmendrick, and you load up the shopping cart. Then what do? You go to checkout. What do? You unload the shopping cart. Then what do? You pay. Now what do? You reload the shopping cart. Then what do?
You schlep it to the car.
Well, then what do? You unload the shopping cart. Then what do? You take the car. You go home. Then what do? You unload the car. And my reasoning here, my deduction is that perhaps the best redesign of the shopping cart is its elimination. And that was another aha moment for me, is that perhaps the best redesign of a sales process in a dealership or in any business, perhaps the best redesign is its elimination.
Yeah.
And that does not mean that you don't keep a physical store. That just means have the option. I don't know about your family. We order about the same crap every week from we get, and there are variances, right? Summer, a couple of watermelons, some fruit. Winter, something a little more hearty. Manage the variances. Otherwise, just hit play it again. But hey, we have enough of that. Don't order that. There's no value to you, to me as a consumer, going to the supermarket. The value is to the supermarket. And so we've got to build the business around the value provided to the customer.
Yep. You know, funny story about the elimination of going to physical grocery stores and so forth. And it's this experience that I had that led me to the comment earlier that yes, you got to be innovative and disruptive, and the timing matters. So in the mid to late 90s, I want to say 96, 97, I was working on the junk bond desk at Goldman, and we did a deal for a company called Webvan. I don't know if you remember them. They didn't last all that long. Yeah. They did online they were setting themselves up to do online grocery delivery. And tell me if this sounds even the least bit familiar. They were going to have regional warehouses where everything was on shelves with conveyor belts, everything automated, and people could check out, and the technology would sort of get the order together and ship it to someone, right? Sounds a lot like what Amazon does, right? Well, do you know this? They were just a little bit too early, because I thought it was fabulous because I was a New Yorker and I was like, oh, the convenience, the time savings. I can't schlep all this heavy stuff from D'Agostino's to my apartment, et cetera, et cetera. So we did the bond deal. We did an IPO. I jumped on board this like it was the last train to a candy store and bought the stock, the whole thing. Anyway, it was too early, and it ended up being a victim of the technology bubble, and my stock turned into birdcage liner. But I thought it was genius.
Yeah, probably a lot of examples like that about what's going on. I mean, we started in the online world and really sort of putting some assets behind it. We were ahead of the market a little bit, and now I think the market's caught up. I mean, it's the internet's no longer informational; it's fully transactional, and that's even for us. The disruption started with the stock industry many years ago, right? With brokers and what do you need a broker for? Most of the data that the brokers would provide to you, he got from or she got from a computer someplace, and now we all had the ability to access very similar information. So I think that's what we call an efficient market, right? Efficient market being defined by the buyer and the seller having the same information, and more of that's going on in the automobile business, and thankfully in many other businesses. So rather than fight it, I think it's embrace it and leverage it.
Yeah. So fight it. Don't fight it. Embrace it. Good tip for leadershifters. Any other last parting words that you want to give anyone in any industry who is facing a lot of uncertainty and disruption?
Disrupt yourself before you're disrupted. You are the smartest person in your industry. You know better than the people from the outside. Be willing to look at it from an outsider's perspective, taking what you have that they don't have, which is the intrinsic value and knowledge of your business, and you want to say, what would Amazon do? What would Google do? What would Apple do? What would Facebook do? And I think you start your journey. And you can't answer that for everybody. They've got to answer it for themselves.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And how can people find you, reach you, buy a car from you?
Well, ParagonHonda.com, ParagonAcura.com, or me, I'm BrianBenstock.com. I love talking to other dealers too, so hit me up on LinkedIn. I like getting feedback from around the nation, and you know, it really helps me figure out what other dealers are struggling with. And it's interesting how we've got a great sort of alumni of people that are working on this together.
Right.
Together is better.
My next call is just popped into our podcast, but she just popped out. So, but before we run, I just want to highlight Leadershifters. Be like Brian, be a student of disruption. Because I think if I could summarize you in one phrase based on everything you shared with us today, that's what it would be. You have been an excellent student of disruption. And I don't just mean because you went to NYU and took a disruption class, right? I mean, you've been dealing with this for a long time and you've shared some really great tips with the audience today, right? Feed the fish the food that they want, not the food that you want, right? We got to adapt and be agile, which means we learn, we unlearn, and relearn. I mean, I've heard that before, but it bears repeating. It's simple, yet not simplistic, and super important. And when you see disruption coming, invest in your business before it's too late. Like, you gotta spend the bucks. It will pay off. And one of the terms that I love, see, I think of ROL as return on leadership. What value do you bring to your organization from excellent leadership? Sure. I will now also know that ROL is return on learning. And what do you learn from taking those risks and innovating in your business, as Brian shared with us today? So again, thank you for joining us, Leadershifters. I hope today has been enlightening for you and is causing you to shift from some old, outdated mindsets and paradigms about your industry and anything else you're involved in, and are leading you to take some shifts in your strategy and building the right culture to support that, like we always advocate. So again, Brian, thank you for your time.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Yeah. Leadershifters, until next time, you know how to reach me, hello@theleadershiftproject.com, theleadershiftproject.com website, and of course, all the social media. This has been such a pleasure. Mwah.